Greeks riot and buildings burn.
As the government votes for more budget cuts.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, February 13th.
Coming up, we'll put the Greek budget cuts in context.
And check out the miracles of D.C. budget math.
Plus, the future of the natural gas industry. We've got an interview with an industry CEO.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Greeks are waking up to another round of budget cuts. They protested in the streets over the weekend as the country's parliament voted to accept a smaller government workforce and a lower minimum wage. The country is a step closer to a deal that would allow it to avoid a nasty default. But the round after round of cutting hasn't been easy for the residents of the country. For more now, we go to Brady Kiesling in Athens. He's a former U.S. diplomat and has lived in Greece for more than a dozen years. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's it like in Greece today?
I was out on my bicycle to view the wreckage. The street sweepers were pretty cheerful. Everyone is busy cleaning up, and life seems to be slowly returning to normal after what really were the biggest demonstrations in the past 3 years anyway.
How has the crisis more broadly affected life there?
Fundamentally, Greece is in a depression. Those people who have money are putting it under the mattress. Lots of people have lost their jobs. Our downstairs neighbor has lost his job. Wages have been cut. And we just saw in Parliament this big slice to wages in the new legislation. And people are scared and they're angry.
And where do you think Greece and the Greek economy goes from here?
The reason people are angry is they look at the measures, they say, yes, we cannot afford to go bankrupt, but at the same time, these measures do not offer any way out of grinding poverty for at least the next 10 years. And people are afraid of that. They're angry. They all went out in the streets last night and shouted until they were tired. And it was somewhat cathartic, but they're still angry and they're looking for an outlet somewhere.
Now, if Greece does get this bailout money, what will it mean for the regular Greek resident?
It will allow things to keep going at their current depressed level for a few more months. The problem is there's nothing on the horizon to show an upturn in the economic cycle. Tourism has done a little better. Of course, the pictures on television last night are not going to help that. But the structural obstacles to doing business here have not been fixed, and there's no sign that the state is going to be able to fix them, not in time to do anyone any good this year.
Now, are you planning to stay in the country?
We're planning to stay. My wife's job is not exactly recession-proof. She's a therapist. Her clients are highly stressed. They need therapy, but they are struggling to make ends meet. More importantly, they're struggling to find time. Doing any business here, they spend half of their lives trying to get the people who owe them money to pay. They're trying to get the state to pay. So doing business here is extraordinarily difficult, and people do not have time to take care of themselves in the way they used to.
Brady Kiesling, thanks for your time.
You're very welcome.
Well, Greek lawmakers did what they had to get more bailout money.
They passed major spending cuts and reforms. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The measures are exceedingly unpopular among the Greeks. Just think about this if it were happening in the U.S. Greece's minimum wage will be cut to $728 a month. In the U.S., the federal minimum is almost twice as much. 150,000 Greek public sector posts will go. If the equivalent cut occurred in the US, 600,000 Americans would be losing their jobs. Student Anna Marie Piscopani says the extra austerity has deepened the gloom in Greece.
We are in a constant fear. We cannot depend on anything. We cannot plan anything because we do not know what's coming. We don't see hope.
There's even uncertainty over whether the latest measures will win Greece a second bailout. The Eurozone finance ministers are demanding some further cuts and will meet on Wednesday to consider whether Greece has done enough. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, let's get some analysis now from our regular Monday guest, Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she's with us from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, who has more to lose here, the Greeks or the European nations like Germany that are going to have to approve the bailout?
You know, that's a terrific question. The Greeks are basically facing a tough road. It can either be stretched out over time with some help from the European nations, or they would have to make it all at once if they don't get the funding. So they have a lot to lose. But for Germans, if we worry about if Greece gets kicked out of the Eurozone, then we worry about Portugal, then Spain, then Italy, and we lose the stability they've worked so hard to get over the last few months. So both parties have a lot to lose here.
And what about Greece? When do you think we can be at the point, if all goes as planned here, where a company decides, you know what, I want to locate in Athens and start hiring some people?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's going to be a matter of years rather than months. Greece has, again, a lot of cuts to make, a lot of reforms to make, and is probably going to be looking at some economic instability and political instability for a while. We can contrast that with Ireland, where they've made a lot of the cuts. Things have gone as scheduled, and actually private investors are starting to come back. So one of the problems with Greece is their inability to get these things passed in a timely way.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Now to the budget cutting here in the U.S. The president has submitted his 2013 spending plan to Congress today. It includes plans to raise taxes on the wealthy and spend billions on infrastructure projects. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports now on how long it would take to get those infrastructure projects going if, and it's a big if, Congress were to say yes.
Infrastructure projects have some downsides. For one thing, they're generally really expensive. And, says economist Paul Bingham with CDM Smith,
it just takes an enormously long period of time. Estimates in the industry of more than a decade from initial design to actually getting final permitting and approval from all the levels of government.
At the same time, not all infrastructure projects are created equal.
Transportation has proven it's a good way to get jobs moving the economy fast.
John Horsley is executive director of the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials. He says funding for roads can be put to use within 6 months.
State, cities, and counties can find a way to pick projects that are not held up by environmental reviews or other bureaucratic obstacles. We can get that money out and working in the economy.
The president is proposing to spend around $500 billion on road projects. Horsley says it would take twice that much to fix all our infrastructure problems. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Many say the budget fight is more politics than policy, but there's another battle coming sooner over an extension of the payroll tax holiday due to expire at the end of February. For more, we go to Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Adrian.
So what is going to happen here?
Well, there's going to be a whole lot more yelling and screaming and threatening and posturing. And then at the last minute, they'll extend the tax holiday 5 seconds before they have to.
Which gives us lots to write about, I guess.
Well, that's the bright side.
How are they going to pay for this extension?
In some sort of nonsensical way that makes no sense to anybody outside of Washington who doesn't speak budget math. Now, the current holiday, you'll be glad to know, the one that expires at the end of the month, was paid for by increasing the fees that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are supposed to charge on new mortgages beginning later this year.
What do these fees that Freddie and Fannie are paying have to do with Social Security?
Well, they have nothing to do with Social Security, except that Social Security is part of the government, right?
Right.
Fannie and Freddie are part of the government.
Okay.
The Congressional Budget Office did a calculation that all of these fees to Fannie and Freddie are the same thing as having $35 billion on hand now. the Social Security holiday for the 2 months cost $35 billion. So $35 billion left from Social Security, $35 billion is coming into Fannie and Freddie, and it balances. And I think even people who are not budget geeks are supposed to understand this, though I'm not sure why.
I think my head has exploded with this budget math.
Well, it could be worse. I could have given you the real version instead of the simplified version. And if you really want an explosion, I'll be glad to explain that all to you offline.
Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan, thanks.
You're welcome, Adrian.
Gas prices are on the rise again. The average price of a gallon is up to $3.51. Meanwhile, prices for natural gas are dropping. Unfortunately, though, most of us can't put natural gas directly into our cars at the moment. So when is the natural gas industry going to be ready for prime time? Bill Johnson is the CEO of Progress Energy. That's an electricity company that deals in natural gas as well as other energy sources like nuclear and coal. He joins us now from Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, so what is the dream scenario for the natural gas industry? How much of our energy future can involve natural gas, and how long is it going to take for that to happen?
Well, from what we know about the gas supply in this country, I think we have 100 years of natural gas here. If we can extract it safely and get it where it needs to be to consumers and companies like ours. But it's a great part of our energy story for the future.
And when you say 100 years, I mean, how much of our energy will be natural gas, will come from natural gas percentage-wise?
Well, I would think over the next decade, we'd be moving toward maybe 25-30% nationwide. So I think over the next decade or so, it's going to burgeon into a main supply of energy, at least for the electricity sector.
I need to ask you about the downsides, which are not insignificant to extracting this natural gas. There have been reports of water contamination, the strong stench of chemicals from fracking, and even an increased number of earthquakes. Why should the public accept these downside risks for an industry that we don't know all that much about yet?
Fracking is not a new thing, or hydraulic fracturing, whatever term you want. We've been doing it for 30, 40 years in this country. And so we ought to be able to do it right, to make sure that there are no environmental impacts from it. It's like any other natural resource. If we're going to use it, we're going to extract it. We have to do it the right way. People pay enough time and attention and look at the science and look at the equipment they use and the methods that we should be able to do this safely.
Then why do you think there's so much opposition already to fracking?
Well, I do think people have the concerns that you mentioned, right? Particularly drinking water, which is on everybody's mind, you know, all the time. I don't have any problem with people being concerned about this at all. I mean, I'd be concerned if there was a problem with my drinking water. That's what we ought to be pursuing. How do we do this safely and get this resource that we really need?
How much of your electricity, energy, car use comes from natural gas right at this moment?
Oh, I'm a Prius driver, so I'm not using natural gas there, and I'm an electricity company person, so that's how I heat my home. But at the company, we're using a lot of it.
Bill Johnson is the CEO of Progress Energy. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to be part of a show that I listen to regularly.
Now to the talk of the NBA, Jeremy Lin, a 23-year-old guard who was recruited by no major college teams. He went undrafted after graduating from Harvard with a degree in economics. He kept being cut by teams as recently as December. Then the New York Knicks picked him up to fill out their roster after some star players went down with injuries.
And that ushered in Lin's sanity. The fans are just going crazy for this guy. He has stolen the spotlight away from big-name players like LeBron James and Kobe Bryant by scoring tons of points and almost single-handedly leading the Knicks to victory again and again. Now, in today's Midday Extra, Jeremy Lin and how his success has already gone global. To explain, we've got Adam Mintner. He's Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, tell us a little bit about Jeremy Lin's story.
Well, it's a remarkable sort of rags to riches in sports story. This guy was known to nobody just on February 3rd, as a matter of fact. He'd been in the NBA for 2 years, but he was pretty much a journeyman, wasn't expected to even make the NBA as he came out of Harvard. And then on February 4th, due to injuries, he got a chance to play for the Knicks against the New Jersey Nets and scored 25 points. A couple nights later, he scored 28 points. And just this past Friday night, he scored 38 points against Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers. And over the course of this week, his story has become the story, not only in the NBA in the United States, but across the world, and particularly here in China, where there's been a keen interest for a long time in seeing Asians succeed in the sport. Aside from Yao Ming, who just retired this past season, there really hasn't been an Asian player in the NBA who's made any kind of impact whatsoever. And that's been a keen business issue for the NBA, because they'd spent a lot of money during Yao's fairly brief career. It lasted under a decade, trying to expand the audience of the NBA in China. And all of a sudden, unexpectedly, this guy who wasn't supposed to ever really be a starter on an NBA roster has brought a lot of attention to the NBA back in China. On China's microblog, the Twitter-like services, he's become the sensation. Over the course of the last week, he's been at the top of trending topic lists. Even now, even though the game was Saturday night, his game against Kobe Bryant is still being discussed. And I just looked at the trending topic list right now, and it's number 8 on the trending topic list. So that gives you an idea of just how important he's become to the NBA in China. And it's all happened over the course of a week.
Now, is this amounting to sales of things like jerseys and game tickets and other Linsanity paraphernalia?
Well, it's actually the economic story, I mean, is a little bit bigger than that, actually. I mean, certainly you've got merchandise being sold. The New York Knicks didn't even have Lin jerseys when he started playing on February 4th, and it took him a few days to do that. But the bigger economic impact has actually been television. In China, you have a potentially huge NBA audience. When Yao Ming was playing, you could have in excess of 100 million people watching a game, which is about the audience of the Super Bowl. That's dropped off considerably. But just in the last week and a half since Lin has come on board the NBA and the Knicks, you see Chinese television stations adding Knicks games. And that's millions of dollars of revenue for the NBA. And you have the same thing happening in the United States. For example, the other night in Minnesota, because he was playing in Minnesota, the Minnesota Timberwolves had their fourth largest audience in history of the franchise. Ticket-wise, when the Knicks played the Lakers the other night, tickets for that game were starting on the scalper sites for $195.
And are the games on at like 8 o'clock in the morning over there?
Yeah, they try and schedule these games usually depending on where they are, West Coast, East Coast, somewhere between 7 and 10 a.m. So it's a morning sport. I mean, American sports in China are morning sports, but what the NBA learned to do when they had Yao Ming was to schedule Friday night and Saturday night games, so you sort of have Saturday morning and Sunday morning basketball, and they have huge ratings.
Now, are people skipping work actually right now to watch these games?
Well, it hasn't reached that stage yet. I mean, it's funny, the two big games in Lin's career, the three big games really have happened over the weekend. Nobody ever heard of this guy, and all of a sudden you started seeing the NBA trending on Sina Weibo, which is the big microblog here. So you've only had one of his games, I believe, maybe it's two games that have actually occurred on weekdays, but I think it wouldn't surprise me if you start seeing people streaming these things and you start seeing people taking peeks of it during the day here, yeah.
Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview. Adam, thanks a lot.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
And by the way, Jeremy Lin's quick rise has had some unexpected consequences. Turns out his old high school basketball coach bought up the website linsanity.com 2 years ago.
That's some foresight.
Yeah, exactly. And he's now using it to sell T-shirts. Smart idea. Problem is, according to the New York Post, that while he had the foresight to get the website going, he did not think to actually print the T-shirts. And now he's got a bit of a back order problem.
Whoops. And finally, have you ever wondered, Jeremy, why Adele makes us so sad and we like her so much? The British singer won 6 Grammys last night, in part because of her ability to make us all a little weepy.
Never mind, I'll find someone like you.
The Wall Street Journal reports there's good reason we keep hitting the play button. Music that makes us emotional, even makes us sad, causes our brains to reward us with dopamine. The more emotions, the more dopamine. And so we choose to listen and get teary-eyed over and over and over.
In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Sometimes it hurts instead.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.